Hello and welcome to the Northern Agenda podcast, bringing you the politics stories that matter to the North and from the North. I'm Rob Parsons, a political journalist based in Leeds who reports on the ups and downs of politics in Northern England, and I put it all into a daily newsletter called the Northern Agenda. This week on the podcast, I thought we'd switch our focus away from the two main political parties to one that seems to be gathering momentum and hopes to do some real damage to the Conservatives at the next general election. Reform UK, founded by Nigel Farage as the Brexit Party back in 2018 and renamed in 2020 to Campaign Against Lockdown Measures during the COVID pandemic, came third in two parliamentary by-elections last week and has promised to field a candidate in every single constituency at the next general election. We know Reform is anti-lockdown, pro-Brexit, in favour of slashing taxes, and it leans into a number of divisive culture war issues. But does it have any policies to improve the lives of people in the north of England? This weekend, it's holding a big spring conference in Doncaster, and I've been talking to one of the main speakers, the Talk TV host, Alex Phillips, who is now one of the party's most high-profile members. I asked Alex about the involvement of Nigel Farage in the party, how Reform plans to hurt the Tories at the ballot box, and why the party would support an end to the ban on fracking, the highly controversial technique for extracting shale gas in places like North Yorkshire and Lancashire that has caused huge local protests before being ruled out by the Conservative government in 2019.
There are those who pull puppet strings from above to try and badmouth things like fracking, whether that be our opponents in other countries using propaganda, activism, so on and so forth. This has really become a huge geopolitical football. And when there's scaremongering taking place over fracking, when you've got the extremes of climate activism, you have to sort of sometimes look under the bonnet.
Plus, I've spoken to a Conservative councillor in Yorkshire who explains why Reform may not have the impact they're looking for and what his party can do to stop them taking votes off the Tories at the next election.
But the Reform aren't really looking at right replacement, they're looking at right eradication. You know, we stand on the brink of, frankly, open kimono time. We stand on the brink of the biggest Conservative collapse, I think, in our electoral history. The next biggest right-wing party in the wake of that collapse stands to gain absolutely nothing other than eliminating us from Parliament.
So let's have a listen now. Alex Phillips, welcome to the Northern Agenda podcast.
Pleasure to be involved.
Thank you for coming on. So you are the daughter of a lorry driver, a Durham University graduate, former MEP, currently a TV and radio host, ex-head of media for UKIP. Tell me about the political journey that took you to being part of Reform UK as you are now.
Wow, I mean, it's a very long journey, so I'll try and get it as short as possible, as condensed as possible. Indeed, daughter of a lorry driver, and my dad was always very vocal about politics at home, as was my mum, both at different ends of the political spectrum, actually. My mum used to be a Lib Dem activist. My dad, a sort of a dyed-in-the-wool Thatcherite from County Durham. There were big debates over the dinner table growing up, so we always had lots of political conversation. I wasn't massively, I don't think, hugely into politics. I did like it. I mean, maybe actually it's kind of unnatural at primary school to go home and watch, you know, repeat of Prime Minister's Question Times, which I did. But I can't remember being particularly an activist or anything at university. But it's when I went to live in Africa to work as a journalist between university and journalism school that I really became enlivened to political debate, particularly around the EU. A strange avenue to get there, I'm sure most people would agree, but there was a big debate going on in Ghana, where I was living, about the EU's economic partnership agreement with the West African countries in ECOWAS. And it was such a lively debate, talking about how much of the EU was a sort of corporate cartel, was going to wipe one third of the GDP of Ghana off the map by getting rid of tariffs, that they were going to flood us with products. And I can remember thinking, wow, you know, the EU is not a benign and benevolent force. At the same time, my father, who was a lorry driver, like you said, had constantly seen his wages suppressed with drivers from Eastern Europe coming in, not having to adhere to the same protocols on whether it be tachographs or certificates, medical checks, licenses, and all the rest of it. And then when I came back and ended up working in journalism, I met Nigel Farage as a sort of a symptom of going and covering the smaller parties as a young journalist. And I just realized that this was a battle I really wanted to get involved in. I thought at the time that the sort of besmirchment of UKIP as racist and far right was totally wrong, that they had a huge point to make about democracy, about the way that the EU actually works. And it isn't just a big, you know, lovely, innocent project for good. It does silence voices and it does sort of tend to favour big business over people and sovereignty. And I felt compelled even to give up my journalism career to pursue that. So that's it. I caught the bug. And that's it. Once you're a political junkie, there is no sort of a methadone to get you off the crack, I'm afraid. And I'm still sort of, you know, keeping my toe in the lot of it today.
So I think it was last year that you announced that you were sort of going to become join in with Reform UK, founded by Nigel Farage, led by Richard Tice. And I think this weekend you are speaking at the Spring Conference in Doncaster, which I see is being described by the party as its possibly its final grandstand event before the next general election. What should we expect from this conference?
Well, there's going to be a lot. To try and sort of, put in a nutshell what our contract with the people is going to involve is going to be very difficult. But I think what people will see as we articulate our ideologies, our political stances, our ambitions, our campaigns across a range of portfolios, I think what people will see is the characterization of Reform as just extra conservative or another option on the right wing of politics is totally wrong. Indeed, the whole argument about Brexit tended to split between classes rather than wings of politics. You know, you had the Red Wall in the north, who traditionally Labour held constituencies who voted overwhelmingly for Brexit. Whereas those constituencies that might have been traditionally red trouser conservative tended to go Remain. And I think what we've seen in politics is this splintering of the concept of what is right wing and what is left wing. There's essentially sort of a centrism in politics now, a centrism which seems to accept that there is a sort of subjugation to global powers. And then there's a populism in politics, which says that a lot of people out there are saying, you know, things are just going wrong for us. We're not feeling the benefits of politics in the 21st century. And I think that Reform is going to lay out a platter of policies and ambitions that will sort of come from the right, come from the left, but are designed essentially to be the voice of people who feel like they haven't been listened to for a long time.
Now, I imagine the interest among Westminster journalists at the Doncaster rally will be, is Nigel Farage going to be there? I think he's in America at the moment, isn't he, with Liz?
He's not physically going to be there.
He's not going to be there.
No, he's not, unfortunately. But he has got a big strong message, and that will be played out at conference. So he can't be in two places at once, unfortunately. And it's our spring conference. As president of the party, we're very sad he's not going to be there. And he's very sad he's not going to be there. But there's a certain Mr. Trump who has asked for his presence in America. And, you know, at some point you've got to make a decision what you're going to prioritise in your diary. And he's able to do it both by pre-recording a video message to play out at conference. And the big question, of course, on everybody's lips is he coming back? I mean, he's not really gone for a start. And, you know, no poker player likes to play their ace card at the beginning of a game, let alone show their hand. And what I'd say is, this is still Nigel's dream. It's still Nigel's party. And he's definitely not exited politics. So everyone's going to have to wait and see what happens going forward.
Now, you have said, I think, last year that you want Reform UK to hold the Conservative Party's feet to the fire so that its skin crackles, which is quite the image. I mean, how do you plan to do that?
Well, I think it's already happening, isn't it? What we're seeing already in the by-elections that have taken place is that Reform is in many seats preventing the Conservatives from keeping hold of that seat in constituencies that really have been theirs forever, you know, that they've got legacy foothold in. And, you know, I've seen this before, of course, with UKIP and the Brexit Party, is as soon as people get fed up with the Conservatives for not listening to them, they move over to parties like UKIP, Brexit Party, Reform, all essentially iterations of the same thing. And then the Conservatives go back in the sort of direction the general public wants. Now, the difference is in times past, when you had a strong UKIP, you had a strong Conservative Party who went on to win a majority. You know, 2024 is very different. You've got an ever-growing and ever-increasing in strength Reform Party at a time that the Conservative Party's back's against the ropes and they couldn't be more unpopular. But I think, you know, this is going back as well to that same old argument that Reform is somehow an alternative vote for the Conservative Party. If we look back at UKIP, UKIP used to get a third of their votes from the Conservatives, a third from the Labour Party, and a third from people who'd never voted before at all. And I think that Reform's appeal is probably far more spread across the political spectrum than is made out by the media. But this is the same old sort of adage that always comes from the media, which is pushed by the Conservative Party, of course, which is a vote for Reform gives you Labour. We do, of course, share a lot of hinterland with the Conservative Party. But we share as much, I would argue, with the Labour Party. And I think it's quite important that we make that case very clear as well at conference that, you know, we're not going to sit back and say, oh, no, Sir Keir Starmer gets a free ride. We want those Labour votes as well.
Because that was what Rishi Sunak said last week after the by-election losses, didn't he? That a vote for anyone who isn't the Conservative candidate, whether that's Reform or anyone else, is just a vote to put Keir Starmer in power. So presumably you disagree with that assessment.
Well, the problem we have is we have a political system that shores up this sort of bipolar narrative that you've got to have one or the other, that you know, there's a choice of two and any other vote is a wasted vote. And I think there's a big political discussion to be had about the first past the post system, because it's not working for people. When you look at the approval ratings of both Sir Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak, both of them have negative approval ratings. So neither of them are actually liked by the public. And imagine that being your choice between two parties that you don't like. One which has proven time and time again to make promises they don't keep, to prioritise party politicking and parlour games over policies, and another which people largely look at and think, well, you know, are they going to be any better than the rubbish lot we've had for the past 13 years? It's a very dismal state of affairs. But this is, you know, the legacy parties are conceited and arrogant, and they use this system to hide behind rather than be accountable to an electorate, because they keep selling this lie to voters that any other vote, if it's not for the two legacy parties, is wasted. And I think it's important that we carry on. And I've been trying to do this for years with UKIP, with the Brexit Party, now, of course, with Reform UK, to say vote for who you believe in. Vote for the policies that really mean something to you. Because unless you are part of the change you want to see, the change won't happen. You know, it's all very well saying, well, you know, I better vote this way, I better vote that way, because I always have done, I'm not going to bother voting at all. Well, guess what? When everybody does that, which is what everyone seems to do, you end up with the same thing. So people have got to act differently and, you know, really start thinking that in a democracy, it's people power actually that makes things change. And when you go to the ballot box, that is your opportunity to challenge the system.
So I wanted to ask you about policy since you mentioned it. And so I write about politics in the North and, you know, issues in the North every day for my newsletter. And the things that I write about most are the terrible transport links in the North of England, the fact that child poverty is on the rise in places like the Northeast, the fact that in many of our communities, institutions that we take for granted, like the NHS and our local councils, are on their knees. Can you explain to me what Reform would do about any of these issues? What does Reform have to say about all these different things that are sort of, are, as far as I can see, the sort of the big issues?
Yeah,
for people in
Well, you know, if I cover that entire slate of policies, it's going to take
me
out. I
realise it's a lot of things to cover.
And I think also I'm worried about pinning myself into a corner, because, of course, we've got a draft contract with the people, but it's not a party manifesto yet. And so it's always dangerous when somebody ahead of having a manifesto starts rolling out policies and saying, look, this is what we're going to do specifically in these areas. But the point of Reform is this. It is reform, wholesale reform of pretty much everything. Reform of the way the National Health Service works, looking at the model of that and actually saying that in this day and age, you know, we have to appreciate that perhaps what was once set up as an institution for the public good isn't working and is failing us. And we need to have a adult debate about that rather than be shouted down about, oh, privatization, it's going to be an American star system. As someone who lived in Europe under European healthcare, which tends to be a hybrid system and benefited from wonderful healthcare and instant availability of doctors and polyclinics, I think that that is a conversation worth having. We also need to look at the way that some of our big utilities are operated and managed and have conversations about nationalizing as well, which is why I say we also look at policies from the left. We need to have a very important conversation about culture and try and reach the areas that two political parties are running this country are far too scared to address. Very important things that do matter to people at home, the creeping censorship in society, the rise of sectarianism in our politics, the sort of, you know, what is often downplayed as woke and culture wars, but are having a real time effect in schools and in workplaces and in sports. So there is a whole lot for us to deal with. Transport as well, you know, HS2, it's now become an absolute joke project, having wasted billions mainly in consultations. And it's now not going to serve the North at all. And that is an utter travesty. As someone who has spent a long time living in the North, we can't keep having a system that prioritises London and all routes must lead to London as quickly as possible. So there's a lot for us to discuss. And of course, the B word, Brexit, the fact that the benefits of Brexit are still not being harnessed. And a lot of this stuff is just happening behind closed doors and not brought to public attention. Thus it ever was. So there's going to be a whole raft of things that we will be discussing, not just at the forthcoming conference, but over the course of months and leading up to a general election campaign. And what I'd say to anybody who wants to know about our policies, rather than listen to me prattle on and trying to remember detail of what we're putting forward, the best thing anyone can advise is go onto the website, read our policies that we've got written there now, so you can take time, take stock, think about them, and think, do I like this? And, you know, Reform is very much an open church as well. And we like people getting in touch and being part of that dialogue and that conversation as we move forward to developing a manifesto.
So speaking more generally, I just wanted to put to you a critique of Reform UK by a Yorkshire Conservative councillor, a man called Tom Jones, who we'll be hearing from a little later in the podcast. He's written a piece in The Critic magazine where he says that Richard Tice is offering, these are his words, an ideologically confusing and unappealing platform of reheated Thatcherite economics with rehashed, unconnected talking points that have little public salience. Now, obviously, we can't, as you say, you're going into the minutiae of the policies later. But what would you say to those who say there isn't a coherent sort of ideology behind Reform UK?
You know, it sounds to me like he's discussing the internal battles of the Conservative Party and the Tory leadership campaign. If you wanted to see Thatcherism in cosplay form, you just have to remember the three leaders all claiming to be more Margaret Thatcher than the other a year and a half ago, wasting an entire summer of, instead of governing the country and managing our economy, having a vainglorious ideological infight. I think if any party is confused, it's the Conservative Party. They constantly fall out about this, change their leader every 5 seconds. Is it the One Nation Conservatives? Is it the ERG? Is it the New Conservatives? Is it PopCon? Is, I mean, that is the muddled and befuddling ideological war front. I mean, Reform knows what we are. We know what we want to do. So we are the alternative to that chaos. And I would say to Tom Jones, it is not unusual to hear a Conservative making such arguments.
I'm sure he will love that Tom Jones gag.
God, it's I had to get it in there.
It's got to be done. Can I ask you, Alex, that this is one that Reform policymakers haven't decided on yet, but fracking is a big issue up in the north of England, caused a huge amount of controversy. But I see in a policy document on Reform's website, it talks about how the UK sits on vast energy reserves of coal, oil, natural gas, shale gas, etc. And let's have £1 trillion plus of levelling up by drilling down. So does that mean Reform would like the moratorium on fracking to be lifted, or is that yet to be decided?
I'm not the party leader, but I'd say that I think that is probably the direction of travel, without doubt. I think, look, you have to look at this from both geopolitical terms national security terms and economic terms, and also you have to lift the lid on why so many people have been driven to be against fracking. So let's start off with the geopolitical terms. We know there's a worldwide energy crisis being precipitated by regimes that are hostile to the West. So at the moment, if we want to keep the lights on, we have to buy fossil fuels from either Russia, or we're not doing that anymore, or from the Middle East. And that is a whole lot going on with the UAE, OPEC, Iran, blocking cargo across the Red Sea. That's going to make that extremely difficult, which is why energy prices are soaring. So we need to get real and say, look, in the meantime, even if it's just economically to fund the green transition, when we sit on fossil fuels that we're otherwise importing in from other countries at a higher price to our own weakness on the global stage, that probably isn't a sensible idea. Secondly, you've got to look at the local economics of this. So places in the north thrived when mining was one of the main industries. My father used to work in the mines in Durham, actually, and yet was a Thatcherite. And back then, I cannot remember there being huge social disputes about, well, the lorries carrying the coal, or when they're drilling in these, in the shafts underground, are there tremors? You know, it was people's livelihoods and they were proud to do it. And it caused huge devastation to entire communities when the mines were shut down. And actually, if you had fracking instead of mining, and fracking is actually a lot cleaner on the environment and essentially causes tremors about the size of a bus going down your street at the very most, these things can actually be done extremely discreetly. They were at one point already happening in national parks and no one spoke about it or knew. So we've got to get real about that. And we've also got to look at the fact that if you brought that employment back to parts of the United Kingdom that suffered when mining was essentially wiped off the face of Britain, then you can use sovereign wealth funds, you can use local community initiatives to drive that money back into communities, which is very important. So then you ask yourself, well, if this is all such a good idea, why is everybody so against it? And what I would say is this: there are those who pull puppet strings from above to try and badmouth things like fracking, whether that be our opponents in other countries using propaganda, activism, so on and so forth. This has really become a huge geopolitical football. And when there's scaremongering taking place over fracking, when you've got the extremes of climate activism, you have to sort of sometimes look under the bonnet and say, well, you know, which shadowy figures are pulling strings here? And you might find a lot of roads lead back to bot farms in Iran and Russia. So there needs to be a sort of real conversation about that.
I would say, having covered sort of fracking protests in places like North Yorkshire and Lancashire, it seems to me like the local concerns about the environmental impact, etc., are genuinely locally held. But isn't there also the argument that in terms of the energy that we would get from fracking, that wouldn't come on stream for several years? So if we're looking to solve our energy crisis now, fracking is not the way that we do that.
Yeah, I'm afraid we cannot solve the energy crisis now. That's the problem. I mean, even in terms of identifying fracking sites and opening up and drilling them, we are talking about several years. It can't just suddenly be done tomorrow and hey presto, everything's sorted. Same with building nuclear power stations, same with even investing in and developing small modular reactors, which are pop-up nuclear plants, which could be British Rolls-Royce technology and a world leader. These things are not instant, and that's dreadful, because what we've had is decades of neglect in having any sort of sensible energy security, which is why we find ourselves in a situation now where we're having to go cap in hand to Qatar and ask for liquefied natural gas. It isn't an overnight solve, I'm afraid, but that still doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking at this, because this problem is not going away. And I totally understand why local residents would be concerned about what does this mean if all of a sudden, you know, our countryside is being fracked. What happens to our houses? What happens to the roads? And those conversations need to be had in the open, and people need to be reassured about that, because in this day and age, actually, you don't have to have high impact level drilling, and there are plenty of ways in which any sort of perceived risk or disruption would very easily be offset.
So to conclude, Alex, can I just ask you about your own personal ambitions in terms of reform? I think you said previously that you would like to be a candidate in the upcoming general election. Have you decided where that might be, or what's your plan in that respect?
Yeah, do you know, it's very difficult. I am tortured over this because I'd love to stand more than anything. I love politics. It's my first love, and I've got a real sense of commitment and duty into really doing something about my convictions, not just being someone who talks about it, but someone who does something. And that always involves sacrifices, I found out already, leaving the BBC to go and work for UKIP, a decision back in 2008 that people thought was utterly crackers. I have a job as a TV presenter, and under Ofcom regulations, I'm not allowed to be both politician and presenter. So that would mean at the very least having to stand down for 6 weeks to campaign in a constituency, which means not being paid for 6 weeks, which as a millennial is pretty impossible. You know, I need to be able to pay rent and feed myself. And also I wouldn't know whether or not I'd have a job to go back to after 6 weeks. So, you know, all of these things have to add up. What I can't do, unfortunately, is just go, oh, yeah, you know, quit my job, go and stand, end up not being elected and have blown myself up in the process. But if I can find a way to do it, I will do it.
So you've not ruled it out altogether, but you're still working out how it can be done.
There's been a lot of conversations that I'm already having to see what's possible.
And in the wider picture, obviously, in the by-elections last week, I think Reform got 13% and 10%. So, you know, a decent chunk of the vote, but obviously not enough to even be close to winning the seat. I mean, is it conceivable, do you think, that Reform could actually win a seat maybe up north in the next general election? Is that possible, do you think?
So much can change. I mean, what was interesting about those two by-elections is it actually concretised what we had seen happening in opinion polling. And so it sort of underscores that, yes, Reform are here. Now the third party in British politics. I mean, that's the important narrative. The fact that, you know, we're beating the Liberal Democrats who've been around forever and actually denying the Conservatives seats in old Conservative constituencies. But it's not enough. You know, 10, 13% is not enough, but we're still a long way away from a general election. I think those two by-elections and even, you know, you having this interview with me now shows that people are recognising the brand and interested. There's still a lot of people out there who probably haven't heard of Reform UK that don't live on Twitter and read all the newspaper apps every day like I do and probably you do. It's a lot of people who are just completely disconnected. And if you said Reform, they'd say, Reform who? So it takes a lot to break into public consciousness. Things like these by-elections help that. A year ago, the media didn't give two hoots. We wouldn't get a single line in the newspapers. And now look, I think all the media are going to turn out to our conference. After those by-elections, people weren't talking about Keir Starmer or Rishi Sunak. People were talking about Reform. And that's what's important. So let's see what happens over coming months. I think that increasing brand awareness, for want of a better phrase, I think that the increasing disenchantment with the Conservative Party, I don't think they've got much to claw back. I think we're seeing already the fracturing of the Labour Party on these ideological grounds based on a war happening 2,500 miles away. And then I think the return of Nigel Farage could all move the needle to an extent that we could be a real challenge in this year's general election. But let's see, still a long way away.
Alex Phillips, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we've heard the pitch from Reform UK. Let's get an alternative perspective now from up the A1M in North Yorkshire from Tom Jones, a Conservative councillor who just this week has written a piece for the magazine The Critic with a pretty brutal headline, Why Reform Are Rubbish. Now, Tom, we've just been hearing from Alex Phillips, who says her party is actually capturing the public's imagination and may even win a seat at the next general election. But in your article, you say the reality is somewhat different. Can you explain?
Yeah, happy to. So I think one of the problems that Reform will face in the general election is basically a dissipation of effort. So as I'm sure everybody who listens to this podcast knows, general elections are very, very expensive. And whilst Reform are very, very well funded for a small party, taking on 650 seats, as they promised to do, is very, very expensive. There's also an issue of candidate quality. So, you know, not everybody is going to be as politically astute and politically able as, for instance, Alex Phillips. You are going to have much less polished media performers. And that does carry some risks and has carried risks with populist parties on the right before, that you get controversial candidates whose past catches up with them. And on top of that, you've got a, at the minute, you know, Reform are very well able to take a kind of Rage Against the Machine perspective. But during a general election campaign, there will be a lot of positive vision from Labour, detraction from Conservatives. And I think Reform's messaging will naturally, its target market will be diminished by the sheer amount of political messaging going out. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult for them to match the results they've had in the by-election, which was, I think, 10% in Kingswood and 13% in Wellingborough. And I think that is probably Reform's ceiling as it stands.
It's less about their policies, in your view, as the limiting factor, but more about their lack of sort of ground game, as it were, to actually win over voters.
I think it's a combination of the two. I think 13% and 10% are the natural limits of their policy platform, but I think that will come down in a general election because of the party's structure and lack of ground game and lack of data and things like that. And the reason I think it's only 13% is, as I think you read this quote to Alex, I think they are offering a confused platform, which is liberal economics, you know, kind of low tax, low spending, which actually, you know, polling, it's important, but polling shows it's not that popular on its own. But I think they, on the culture side, you know, straying away from economics, I think their policy platform is very confused. I know Richard Tice talks about the WEF, common sense coal, taxing working from home. He goes on about the woke brigade in California.
WEF, that's the World Economics Forum, isn't it? Sort of big global organization.
Yeah, and these are talking points that have very little public salience, but also they are very, very disconnected. And talking about disconnected issues is a very dangerous game in politics, because people thrive on stories and they thrive on narrative. And it makes it very, very difficult for Reform to explain how we got to where we are and where Reform intend to take us. It's very, very easy to rage against things, but in order to create a positive path forward, you need to be for things as well.
Now, you're right. I did put that the point about the sort of the mixture of policies to Alex, and she, as people will have heard, came back with the point that with three leaders in the space of just a few months and constant factions fighting for attention in the Conservative Party, it's perhaps the Tories that are confused as to what their story is at the moment. And I guess if you look at things like immigration and tax sort of issues, where it's, you know, there's different, depends who you talk to within the party as to what the narrative is there. I mean, is that a fair point, that the Conservatives aren't putting forward a coherent message on a lot of these issues as well?
I think there's a difference between being unpopular because voters don't understand what you stand for and being unpopular because voters understand what you stand for but don't like it. But broadly, all the points that Alex raised are right. And this is part of the reason that the Conservatives are doing so poorly. There is a lot of talk in right-wing circles already about post-power politics, which, if you're talking about post-power politics, means you're not talking about the general election, because you're already thinking after that. You're already thinking what happens after defeat. But I think after 13, 14 years in power, I think we have had a lot of factionalism in the party. I think there's a Dominic Sandbrook quote that we have overseen a government that has instituted factionalism on a scale to rival the Borgias. which is really something. But yeah, I think Alex is right. There is a very, very broad offering from the Conservatives at the minute. And part of the issue with that is that the Conservatives have always been a broad church. And after 13 years in power, so many of factions have come in, been in power, gone out, come back in, that we're basically not quite sure at the minute what we stand for anymore.
And presumably that the fear or the suspicion is that reform will do sufficient damage to the Conservatives' electoral prospects, maybe costing them seats that otherwise they might have won, that the defeat at the next general election is even worse than it might otherwise have been. And then, as you say, post power in after the election, when you're deciding who is going to be the next leader of the Conservatives or which direction the party goes in, the party ends up lurching to the right and in line with what reform is currently saying.
Yeah. And again, I think that speaks to the limits of reform's vision, actually. Right-wing parties have been replaced in the past. You know, there is the very famous example of Canada in the early 90s, in which the incumbent right-wing party was completely replaced by a new right-wing party that is looks set now to come back into power. But the reform aren't really looking at right replacement. They're looking at right eradication. You know, we stand on the brink of, frankly, open kimono time. We stand on the brink of the biggest Conservative collapse, I think, in our electoral history. And we have been going for quite a number of years now. And the, you know, next, the next biggest right-wing party in the wake of that collapse stands to gain absolutely nothing other than eliminating us from Parliament.
So with that being the case, if you had the ear of CCHQ, maybe perhaps you do, how do the Conservatives see off the threat or mitigate the threat of reform at the ballot box in not just the general elections, but in the local elections coming up as well? Is there anything you can do to stop this?
I think in terms of preventing reform, I think our big problem is that we have spent quite a lot of time talking tough on issues and promising action and perhaps under-delivering, that's putting it diplomatically, in case anybody from CCHQ is listening. I think we've done a lot of talking about a lot of issues, about reducing immigration, about, you know, fighting woke institutions, things like that, things that have generally popular support. And it doesn't seem to get beyond the Telegraph headline a lot of the time. And meanwhile, you know, whilst we are not building nuclear power stations, energy gets more expensive for people. As we are not building HS2, you know, train times are getting slower. So I think there is a lack of ambition in delivery that I think is basically our only route to power. We've got to put our pedal to the floor.
Tom Jones, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Thank you for listening to the Northern Agenda podcast. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our daily newsletter at thenorthernagenda.co.uk. It's more important than ever for Northern voices to be heard. The Northern Agenda is a laudable production for Reach. It's presented by me, Rob Parsons, and it's produced by Daniel J. McLaughlin. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Northern Agenda wherever you listen to your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Also, check out the other laudable podcasts. See you next week. Bye-bye.